It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studio once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Let's got a lot to cover, so let's just jump into things.
Yeah.
All right. First thing on our agenda is the transit package that's pegged for this fall.
Yes.
Wrong.
We're going to talk about it.
Just in case you thought that there was going to be any relief coming to gridlock anytime in the next, decade or two.
You'd be wrong.
Are you talking or are you playing with your headphones over there?
I'm playing with my headphones.
Okay. So you want to talk about the transit package?
Sure, we can talk about the transit package. It's interesting. This week, the Regional Transit Investment Board, which is the group of officials from the three counties, Pierce, King, and Snohomish, got together, and they were going to decide whether or not to actually put the transit package on the ballot. Now, the decision had really already been made for them by the funders. That's a group of large businesses who were looking at the proposed plan and were supposedly doing a poll of voters in the region to find out if people would vote for this package or not if it were on the ballot.
And now these are businesses. These are not public agencies.
That's right. These are businesses like Microsoft and Vulcan and so forth who decide, and Boeing, and they decided they would do a poll or pay for a poll to be done. And then if the poll showed that voters would not approve the package, that then they would refuse to fund an ad campaign to support the regional transit package and that it should not go on the ballot. So they had pretty much decided that, no, they didn't want to fund this package and it wasn't going to go on the ballot. And it's interesting, the Regional Transit Investment Board is the group that is supposed to officially decide that, and they had their meeting this week and they sat down, and interestingly enough, when they sat down to talk about it, the folks on the board who recommended that the package be killed and not put on the ballot in November talked as if they had not seen the poll that was done by the funders. So I'm and the poll remains secret, something that's not, that the public can't view. So I'm kind of interested. I would like to know what is in this poll, how the questions were asked, what questions were asked, who and how many people were called, and in what parts of the three counties. And I'd like to know, you know, why that nobody's been able to see it, including the people who are sitting on the Regional Transit Investment Board who should be making this decision. Also, I'd like to know if the poll was something more than just the Washington Business Roundtable folks just sitting down and saying, well, we don't like the mix of projects in this package, let's kill it.
Yeah, and that's a larger question also. There's a question of how it is that companies like Boeing and Microsoft are being given veto power over what appears on the ballot in this. You know, it's like they have the vote first, and then if they approve of it, then the voters get a chance. But they have the first crack at it. It seems like that's kind of a bass-ackwards way to run a democracy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to know who the rocket scientists were that came up with that one. So, anything else on that?
No, let's move on. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about.
All right. David Dellinger.
Yeah, he passed on last week. For folks who vaguely recognize the name, he was the guy who, he was 88 years old, passed on of things that 80-year-olds pass away from in a nursing home in Vermont. But he was a remarkable guy. He is probably best known as one of the Chicago Seven, the anti-war defendant leaders who were rounded up and prosecuted after the Chicago Convention protests in 1968. But he was a guy who had 30 years of activism before that, another 30 years after. He was active really right up through the last Iraq war. I helped edit a calendar that came out in 2002 that he wrote something for. He really embodied a remarkable amount of living history, going all the way back to the Spanish Civil War, the Dorothy Day Catholic Worker Movement in the 1930s. He was one of the federal prisoners who helped integrate Danbury by fasting and protesting in 1942 during World War II, while being a conscientious objector to World War II. And it really was an inspiring life in a lot of ways. And one of the reasons that it was inspiring was that he started with a philosophy, and the philosophy was really the Gandhian one of love for all people, including enemies, including oppressors, including people in security forces. And it's just it's a sad thing that he's passed on, but he leaves an incredible legacy for us to emulate and to build on.
All right. Moving along.
So didn't get much media attention, so I just wanted to put in a plug for A Life Well Lived.
All right. Thank you. Michael Moore had some good news this week.
He's alive, yes.
He's not in a nursing home.
Folks who are already fans of Michael Moore's documentaries will know that his recent film Fahrenheit 9/11 took the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival in Europe, and that it's screened elsewhere, but it hasn't opened in U.S. theaters yet. But this week it got a distributor for the United States, the Weinstein brothers, who had helped to fund the making of the film, decided to buy back the distribution rights from Disney, which had refused to distribute the film, and now they have put together what Michael Moore calls a coalition of the willing to actually fund the distribution of the film here in the U.S. So we'll be able to see it starting June 25th, 26th. It's going to open in theaters in the U.S. So that's some good news.
And should be well worth seeing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The
buzz on it is very, very good.
It's very good, yeah. And I had some questions about whether or not the film would actually get shown before the elections, and apparently it will.
All right. So two good films coming out. That's on June 26th, and then Corporations opening here in town on the 18th.
Yeah, that showed at the film festival and was very, very good.
Yeah, that's Mark Akbar's documentary on Corporations and how they're treated as individuals in the U.S.
Yeah,
they're treated much better than individuals in the
and
U.S.,
they have significant rights, and he questions whether or not they ought to.
I had a chance to see that at the film festival. It was excellent.
All right. Moving along, Brandon Mayfield. Who is Brandon Mayfield?
Brandon Mayfield is the Portland lawyer who was detained for a number of days as a quote-unquote material witness, never actually charged with a crime, but he was being held in conjunction with the Spanish train bombing in Madrid, where apparently there was a fingerprint match that he was accused of being one of the terrorists, basically, who helped to plant the bomb, and protested his innocence, and eventually was released a couple of weeks ago after it was determined that the fingerprints were not in fact a match, and in fact the fingerprints weren't even close to being a match. Well, it's starting to come out now that not only were the fingerprints not a match, but the Spanish authorities had insisted from the beginning that Mayfield was the wrong guy. It was the FBI in the United States who had made the fingerprint match, who had determined that Mayfield was their guy, and who was trying to build a case against him primarily because he was a Muslim and because he had some ties to one of the defendants in a previous...
He's a lawyer, too.
Yeah, he's a lawyer. So he had some ties to defending one of the peripheral defendants in a previous terrorist case in Portland. It really is... It's a remarkable stain on the FBI that this level of incompetence really was allowed to happen with a fingerprint match that wasn't close, and then covering it up, because the FBI has been insisting all along that it was the Spanish authorities that were to blame for making the match, and Spain is now insisting that no, it wasn't us at all. In fact, and they have the documentation showing that in meetings with FBI officials in Madrid throughout the course of the investigation, he was finally released when the Spanish authorities went and arrested an Algerian national for the same crime, whose fingerprints were an exact match. For some reason, the FBI had it after Mr. Mayfield, and it really is kind of a scary lesson of what can happen when somebody who is a completely innocent citizen gets a knock on the door from FBI agents saying, you know, we're going to take you down, basically, and they very nearly did.
And he was in detention for a while too, wasn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah, no, he was in jail in Portland for I think about 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And being threatened with it, I mean, you know, the crimes he was being threatened with charge can carry the death penalty. So, I mean, it was a fairly serious incident.
So it was very serious.
All right, well, moving along. George Tenet, somebody who has his fingerprints on a lot of things, is...
And it was guilty. I cannot believe that it took this long to get rid of this guy. I mean, you want to look at two, and if you want to count the what will surely become a huge scandal, or should, with Ahmed Chalabi and the loss of intelligence to Iran, which we'll talk about in a minute. Possibly three of the biggest intelligence failures in U.S. history, including 9/11 and the whole scandal around weapons of mass destruction supposedly existing in Iran, in Iraq, yeah. Rather. These all happened on George Tenet's watch. And yet he's been able to hang on for 7 years, and he's now finally being forced out.
Although, the way I look at it, Tenet was a team player.
Oh, very much so.
He took his cue from the higher ups in the Bush administration. It was guys like
he's a fall guy for
Dick
for other
Cheney
people.
And Donald Rumsfeld and so forth, who really pushed him to come up with support for their theory that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And what disturbed me, I just finished reading Bob Woodward's book. One of the things that really disturbed me is that he doesn't talk much at all about Dick Cheney's role in massaging the data before Colin Powell gave his presentation to the UN. He doesn't even mention that Dick Cheney spent a whole week at the CIA headquarters sifting through material to present to Powell, for Powell to look at, to use as data to present to the UN. There's no discussion, really, he discusses a little bit of the hardliners in the Bush administration, but he doesn't really show you the relationship between them and how much they pushed this whole issue of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But he does show you that Tenet really was a team player, that he takes his orders from George Bush and Bush's other high cabinet members.
Yeah, I've also read the Woodward book, and there's a lot of valuable information in there, and it's a shame. And as with the previous book, Bush at War, that Woodward really doesn't give any context to a lot of these things. It's just this meeting happened, then that meeting happened, then this consultation took place, and it's valuable documentation, and there's good information in there, but he doesn't really give it the context, and he really doesn't cover some of the players that weren't in the executive office.
Yeah, that's true.
Happening outside that very central area. So some of the back channel stuff that's going on doesn't get attention.
Yeah, that's true.
And to be fair, I don't think one would, at least I wouldn't use intelligence failure with talking about what he did with Tenet and his organization did with Iraq. I mean, that was intelligence manipulation.
Yeah, very, very much so. But at the same time, clearly the CIA went along with that.
There were some failures to check sources, for example, with the mobile bioweapons lab charges.
Well, failures to exercise common sense, for one thing.
Yeah, that's very true. But when sources were presented for some of that information, the CIA didn't interview them directly. They relied on the summaries given to them by foreign intelligence agencies. They didn't they didn't check their sources, in other words. And not until after we invaded and the weapons of mass destruction couldn't be found, then the CIA went and checked their sources. And lo and behold, these guys were fabricators.
Right, but don't you have the impression that they didn't check those sources because they wanted to go along with that?
Right, Tenet was taking his orders. If anything, he wasn't standing up for the integrity of the whole intelligence gathering process.
Exactly,
his marching orders from the Bush administration.
Yeah, that's where the failure was, and they were producing intelligence that they knew that their bosses wanted to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, moving along, that takes us to This Week in Iraq.
Yes, I want to start by talking about the toll in Iraq. The Associated Press reported this week that more than 200 U.S. troops were killed in April and May of this year. That's an average of 2 per day. That's approximately double the rate of combat deaths that were in previous months of the war, particularly in January and February, which were already higher than combat deaths during 2003. Total U.S. troop deaths so far have surged past 800 this week, with the most recent being 5 troops killed in 1 ambush when a rocket-propelled grenade hit their Humvee on Friday. Now, an unknown number of civilians have died this week from a series of car bombings in Baghdad, which seem to be tied to the announcement of a new government appointed by the United States. Also, large numbers of civilians have been killed in Kufa and Najaf, where U.S. patrols have repeatedly violated a ceasefire agreement. Now, that's according to moderate Shiite politicians who are trying to broker some end to the fighting in those holy Shiite cities of Najaf and Kufa and Karbala. They have charged U.S. troops with violating the ceasefire instead of the Shiite militia, as the U.S. media has said. Now, George Bush's recent assertion that U.S. troops are respecting Shiite holy sites while disarming quote-unquote illegal militias is entirely wrong on all counts.
he needs a laugh track sometimes,
yeah,
I swear.
Anyone who's been following the fighting knows that mosques have been destroyed in Fallujah, Karbala, and Kufa, damaged in Najaf. U.S. troops have rolled their tanks across the holy cemetery in Najaf, and fighting has damaged the sacred shrine of Imam Ali. Now, meanwhile, al-Sadr's militia only seems to be growing stronger and more persistent and better able to fight U.S. troops to a standstill as they have in recent days. Now, al-Sadr himself is becoming much more popular simply by virtue of standing up to the U.S., and that's also going to be a problem because it's polarizing the Shiite community. Moderate Shiite leaders are having less and less influence on the hearts and minds of the Shiite population in general, and many, many more people are coming out to support al-Sadr, and that's going to be a problem in the future. Now, meanwhile, I mentioned the new interim government that was appointed by the U.S. It was sworn in this week. And the governing council dissolved itself. But not to worry, most of the members of the governing council managed to find positions in the new interim, what I call the interim government. Now, the new prime minister is a man named Ayed Alawi, who we talked a little bit about him last week. He has major CIA connections and connections to British intelligence. He's lived for more than 30 years as an exile, has no experience as a politician. He's actually a physician. He's still on the CIA's payroll to the tune of about $10,000 per month. He is, however, secular. He's not a religious figure. He lacks any ties to Iran, which makes him plus in the eyes of the Bush administration. And, however, he is responsible.
Unlike Ahmed Chalabi.
Right, Chalabi. But he's not a whole lot more reliable than Ahmed Chalabi. He is the guy who came up with the 45-minute claim. If folks remember, that was another big scandal in intelligence, the 45-minute claim that Iraq could arm chemical weapons in particular, of mass destruction on the battlefield within 45 minutes, and that proved to be not only untrue, just laughably false. Now, he was not the UN envoy Lakhdar Brahimi's top choice. It was Paul Bremer who really pushed him on the governing council, kind of got the governing council together and told them they had to vote for this guy. And that move, a move that spurred Lakhdar Brahimi to call Paul Bremer the dictator of Iraq this week, got the governing council so angry that they refused to ratify the selection for president. Bremer and Brahimi wanted Adnan Pachichi, the aging secular Shiite politician, to be the new president of Iraq. The governing council said, no, we're not going to vote for that guy. We want this other guy, Ghazi Yawar. He's a Sunni businessman who's been a little bit critical of the U.S. occupation in Iraq. Now, Yawar is not such an independent. I mean, he's being portrayed as not the U.S.'s choice, and the U.S. is not happy with him, et cetera, but he's not that much of an independent. He also has ties in Washington, D.C., and to Saudi Arabia, so he's not considered a complete disaster for the Bush administration. They also, I'd have to say, Paul Bremer went on and got his way in the selection of the rest of the government as well. The two vice presidents, one is a Shiite former member of the governing council, and the other is president of the Kurdish National Assembly. That raises issues of perhaps conflict of interest there, to take the president of the Kurdish National Assembly and make him the vice president of the new Iraqi government. Now, the rest of the ministers, many, many, many of them are returning exiles, and a number of them are former members of the governing council or their associates, so there's not much new blood there, which has led a lot of the Iraqi people to look at the new interim government and say, new government, same as the old guys, pretty much. Now, Lakhdar Brahimi came up with another great quote this week after he called Paul Bremer the dictator of Iraq. It's a quote that I heard on NPR again this morning, and I think people should hear it over and over and over again. The quote is, "I think it's a little bit too easy to call everybody a terrorist. I think if you find out that there are people who are not terrorists, who are respectable, genuine Iraqi patriots, you must find a way to talk to them." In other words, he's saying that the insurgents are not foreign terrorists, they're possibly Iraqi patriots, and that's a very strong contradiction of the Bush administration's position on that.
Yeah, it really does underscore. I mean, the UN envoy is really the last great hope of Washington for having some sort of international credibility in Iraq, and for him to come out with such strong repudiations of the Bush administration of Paul Bremer really says an awful lot about how little credibility this new Iraqi government is going to have in the international community in terms of being seen as independent of Washington. It's not. It's not independent of Washington at all. You know, if there were any thoughts at all in Washington that Iraq was going to have a free choice in terms of what it would be doing, they wouldn't be building 14 permanent military bases in Iraq right now.
Right. Now, on the international scene too, it's kind of interesting that you say that, Jav, too, because at the same time on the international scene, the UN's debating the US's draft resolution for turning over sovereignty to this new interim government in Iraq.
And that's not going well.
It's not going well, no. But one of the things that the other nations on the Security Council are asking for, pushing for, demanding is full sovereignty for this interim government, even though it's a group of people who are former exiles with close ties to the U.S. and who will be looking for support and looking to the U.S. for approval for nearly everything they do. Now, there were two new drafts of the U.N. resolution that the U.S. had to propose this week. The first one set a rough date for U.S.-led U.N. troops to leave Iraq. That was one of the major points of contention. Quote, and it's, quote, "upon completion of the political process," which is very vague and has led a lot of other countries.
Could mean almost anything.
Yes, led a lot of the countries on the Security Council to say, no, we need a more definite date. It would also put Iraqi security forces under Iraqi control, but would not put any U.S.-led forces under Iraqi control. And it tightened language giving Iraq control of its oil revenues. However, France, Algeria, China, Germany, Chile, Russia, and the new Iraqi foreign minister appointed by the U.S. all said that that wasn't enough. And so a second draft was proposed that with revisions that said it would give the sovereign government of Iraq the ability to kick U.S. troops out of the country if it wanted to. Now, using the term sovereign government of Iraq is kind of tricky, given that just about everybody on the Security Council knows that this resolution does not give the interim government full sovereignty. So that, again, is vague language that's being debated. Now, the Bush administration wanted this resolution to be passed this Sunday, so tomorrow they wanted to vote on the UN resolution. That's probably not going to happen, and it's just another indication of how impatient the Bush administration is with diplomacy.
Yeah, and meanwhile, every European capital is having massive demonstrations when Bush shows up.
Yeah, like the thousands who turned out in Rome,
or the ban that's been made on public demonstrations in Paris, which is actually even more of a repudiation than if the thousands had shown up. It's saying that there are so many people that would protest George Bush that we can't even dare have them on the streets. It's remarkable.
Right. That's right. Now, I just want to finish with a couple of little shocking tidbits of news here. One is Ahmed Chalabi. It was leaked a few weeks ago that several months ago he had told Iranian intelligence that the U.S. had cracked their secret codes and that he had got this information from a drunk official in the Bush administration. The FBI is now trying to figure out who that person was in the Bush administration who got smashed and told Chalabi this information. But a new bit of information leaked this week. Ahmed Chalabi had passed classified information to Iran 9 years ago. in 1995 about a CIA-backed plan to assassinate Saddam Hussein. Now, the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency, that's the Pentagon's intelligence arm, have known that Chalabi is a spy for Iran for 9 years, and yet they still relied on him and his organization for intelligence of weapons and mass destruction in Iraq. That shows you some of the deep incompetence that that there is in the Bush administration. And it's interesting that even now, after this stuff has come out in the public and has been printed in the press, that there are still conservatives in the Bush administration who support Chalabi, including Richard Pearl, who is his main backer, and then Donald Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz, who continue to make excuses for him. Now, the second little tidbit of information is that Time magazine got its hands on an email from March 5th, 2003, from an Army Corps of Engineers official that claims that Dick Cheney helped Halliburton get its no-bid contract in Iraq. The quote is, "We anticipate no issues since action has been coordinated with the VP's office." Pretty clear reference to the vice president's office smoothing the way for Halliburton to get this contract with no competition.
And that's a level of corruption that should be impeachable. I mean, that's astonishing.
That in one place. I found actually two places in the Time magazine article and one other place. So it's not getting widely reported, and it should be front page news.
I had one other tidbit also very quickly, which was that Pat Tillman, people may remember the NFL player who walked away from $1 million of contracts to sign up for the Army after 9/11 and then was killed in a heroic firefight in Afghanistan. Well, it came out this past week that it wasn't killed in a heroic firefight after all. It was killed by friendly fire, which raises the question once again of, similar to Jessica Lynch, if there was there's some sort of PR machine going that has to have these publicly seen figures as being, you know, some sort of heroic effort when in fact the dirty reality of war is something very different. There's real efforts going on to propagandize the American public when it comes to these deaths, and we should be cognizant of that when future deaths happen,
pretty obscene when we don't get to see the reality of the deaths, the coffins coming home, the military funerals, etc.
Yeah, we have a Memorial Day in which we're not supposed to pay attention to the current dead, just the ones from 60 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, with that, we are out of time. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And understand, in addition to the usual support you're looking for, you guys are in the middle of a pledge drive.
A fund drive. That is right. Well, a crock pot of state, I believe, is how it's been how it's been set up. But yeah, we we are a community-based publication that comes out every other week, and we've been doing that for a number of years with very, very little money. And we're out of money, so we're trying to raise money to continue with our publication, with our website.
We need to pay our printer debt, and build up a little reserve for the coming months.
Yeah, and that is entirely where the money goes. The vast majority of our budget goes to the printer and to postage for subscriptions, and that's really about it. A little bit more for a layout and administration. If people can donate, that's great. You can check it out on the website at www.eatthestate.org. The information is also in the newspaper itself, or you can send donations to P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145.
All right. And I understand on the website you have a little PayPal thing that people
can click on, make credit cards, get your credit card out, and make those donations, because we can absolutely use the help, and it helps us keep this information coming to you.